Good afternoon, everyone, or good morning or good evening, perhaps, if you're outside the UK. My name is Andres Velasco, and I'm the Dean of the School of Public Policy here at the London School of Economics. And welcome to this online event on the humanitarian dimensions of the war in Nagorno-Karabakh. In today's event, we would like to focus not on the war proper, but on the humanitarian situation following the war. This involves violence against civilians during the conflict, the need to ensure the basic needs of the population today, and the well-being of returning residents in Karabakh, as well as the fate of those who have been displaced. And of course, the lives and livelihoods of the communities on both sides of the border between the two countries. We have two very distinguished panelists to help us think and sort out some of these issues today. I'm very pleased to welcome Lawrence Brewers and Joe Laycock to the LSE today. They will speak for about 10 or 12 minutes each, offering their perspectives on the humanitarian consequences of the armed conflict. Let me introduce briefly each one of them. Lawrence Brewers is the Caucasus Program Director at the London-based peace-building organization, Conciliation Resources. He has more than 20 years experience as a researcher of conflicts in the South Caucasus and a practitioner of peace-building initiatives throughout the region. He's also a prolific author. He is the author of Armenia and Azerbaijan, Anatomy of a Rivalry, which was published in 2019, and the co-editor of the Handbook of the Caucasus, published in 2020, and of Armenia's Velvet Revolution, Authoritarian Decline and Civil Resistance in a Multipolar World, also published in 2020. Joe is a senior lecturer in migration history at the University of Manchester. Her work examines the consequences of conflict and displacement in Armenia, both in the short and in the long term. Her current work addresses also the displacement and resettlement in the region after the First World War and the Armenian Genocide. She is the co-editor with Dr. Francesca Piana of the book Aid to Armenia, Humanitarianism and Intervention from the 1890s to the Present Day. That book was published by Manchester University Press also in 2020. So both of our guests have been very busy writing important books in the last couple of years. For people in the audience, if you're going to use Twitter, the hashtag for today's event is LSE Conflict. This online event, like all online events at the LSE, is being recorded so that people will be able to listen to it afterwards. And as usual, after the panelists, we will have an opportunity for people joining the event to ask questions and do so in the usual manner, of course, putting the questions into the Q&A feature of Zoom. And time permitting, I will try to pass on as many of those questions as possible to our panelists. So without any further ado, I am going to hand it over to Dr. Lawrence Brewers for his the first set of remarks. Lawrence, over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andres, and thank you for the invitation to speak today. My thanks also to Babken for his work in pulling this event together. In my comments, I'll sort of address, I'll try to frame the humanitarian issues that emerged during the conflict, the issues as they stand today, and then a few reflections on the situation going forward. So although this war that began on the 27th of September was relatively brief at just 44 days, it caused a great deal of destruction. And in terms of recent wars in the South Caucasus, it was particularly heavy in its human toll. So by the latest counts, more than 6,000 were killed in action. That's nearly 140 per day on average, and more than 10,000 people were wounded. And to give a sense of the intensity of this war, in just 6 weeks, this war killed the equivalent of a fifth Of those who died over 6 years of violent conflict between Armenians and Azerbaijanis between 1988 and 1994. Now, that earlier war featured colossal and multifaceted humanitarian crises across the conflict divide, several aspects of which, such as mass forced displacement of more than 1 million people and thousands of missing persons cases, were never resolved and indeed fed into the more recent war of last year. So during the war in 2020, civilians were very much in the line of fire. More than 150 civilians, a majority of them Azerbaijanis, were killed. The war featured the extensive targeting of populated areas. In Nagorno-Karabakh, the cities of Stepanakert, Mardakert, Martuni, and others were shelled consistently, causing mass destruction, displacement, and dozens of deaths. Azerbaijani towns around Nagorno-Karabakh, such as Terter and Berde, were also extensively bombarded. Missile strikes on the Azerbaijani towns of Ganja and Berde resulted in dozens of Azerbaijani civilian deaths, including the worst single loss of civilian lives, a strike on the 28th of October that killed 21 civilians. Large numbers of people were displaced. More than 60% of the de facto Nagorno-Karabakh Republic's population, or around 90,000 people, were displaced by mid-October, either within Nagorno-Karabakh or for most of them to Armenia. This included some 17,000 people who had settled in the occupied territories around Nagorno-Karabakh proper in the intervening period since the last war. Approximately 40,000 Azerbaijanis are also reported to have been displaced and to have lost homes to bombardment and missile strikes. Cluster munitions were reported by international human rights organizations to have been used by both sides. These are prohibited weapons that disperse small explosives across a large area in quite an indiscriminate way and can linger on as live munitions long after the conflict. Neither Armenia nor Azerbaijan are signatories to the Convention on Cluster Munitions. Banned white phosphorus munitions were also used during the war. Each side accuses the other, although as far as I know, there only appear to be cases or evidence of burns consistent with the use of those weapons on the Armenian side. There are also extensive documented war crimes, including the execution of prisoners, both civil and military, the mutilation of corpses, and the humiliation of captured soldiers. Some of these incidents, namely the execution of prisoners, of civilians captured on video, have become emblematic through dissemination across social media of the complete collapse in Armenian-Azerbaijani relations following this war. So in terms of humanitarian issues on the ground right now, there are the immediate needs of those that have been displaced. There has been a process of return to those parts of Nagorno-Karabakh that are under the Russian peacekeeping mandate. President Putin has recently spoken about 48,000 people having returned. If that figure is broadly accurate, this would suggest that more than 40,000 Armenians from Nagorno-Karabakh remain displaced. By one count, 120 settlements that had been populated by Armenians ended the war under Azerbaijani control. And I'd like to cite the conclusion of a very recently implemented needs assessment among displaced people from Nagorno-Karabakh that was carried out by the Vanadzor-based NGO Peace Dialogue. With their focus group, the prevailing opinion is that even the settlements under the control of Armenian forces are so close to Azerbaijani settlements and the positions of the latter are so favorable that the issue of security becomes the number one preventive reason to think about return. The rehabilitation of settlements and infrastructure damaged during the war is another key issue. This is obviously a massive and multifaceted undertaking, from clearing unexploded ordnance and demining to restoring basic services. This is complicated by questions of access. It is only the International Committee of the Red Cross and the HALO Trust that currently have access to Nagorno-Karabakh itself, and it's as yet unclear what role United Nations agencies will be able to play, even if one of them, the UNHCR, is explicitly mentioned in the 10th of November 2020 trilateral agreement between Russia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. Current humanitarian concern is also focused on prisoners. This is a particularly salient issue on the Armenian side, as an unknown number, but at least in the dozens of Armenians, are still being held on the Azerbaijani side, even though the 10th of November agreement mandated the release of all prisoners. The Red Cross is engaged in tracing and monitoring the situation, facilitating the transfer of human remains. So, reflecting more broadly, I think we can safely say that 2.5 decades of mutual demonization across the conflict divide certainly took its toll. Whereas there were actually spontaneous humanitarian exchanges and initiatives during the first Karabakh war, in this war, global social media audiences amplified humanitarian violations, causing local and global polarization. Relations between the sides were so embittered that some standard humanitarian practices, such as prisoner exchanges and releases, got caught up in the political dynamic. Humanitarian ceasefires failed repeatedly during the war. International efforts to secure the exchange of prisoners and remains while the war was still ongoing also failed. And to this day, as I mentioned, the holding of prisoners also seems to have become embedded in a political rather than humanitarian dynamic. This war was consistent with the previous one in that no populations belonging to one of the two nationalities remained after the transfer of territorial control to the other. The Armenian population of that part of Nagorno-Karabakh proper that ended the conflict under Azerbaijani control is extremely unlikely to return and forms the latest cohort in the cycle of reciprocal ethnic cleansing between Azerbaijanis and Armenians. And beyond continuing local enmity, addressing humanitarian concerns appears likely to remain mired in the wider conflict dynamic. This new situation that we have today is not the best case scenario for any of the parties, with the arguable exception of Turkey. So the basis for peace is extremely unclear, and the parties themselves, Armenia and Azerbaijan, appear to remain locked in a conflict paradigm. So the scope and entry points for outside actors, including humanitarian ones, are correspondingly few, which suggests that, like the previous war, this war will have an unresolved humanitarian legacy on which future entrepreneurs of Armenian and Azerbaijani conflict can draw. And I'll stop my comments there.
Thank you very much, Lawrence, for that very clear, very informative, and of course, quite sad set of facts and assessments you've shared with us. Let me turn it over to Jo for her introductory set of remarks. Jo, over to you. Thank you. You're muted, I'm afraid.
Thank you for inviting me to speak to you today. And thank you, Lawrence, for setting out the issues and the context so clearly. I want to address three issues that arise from the humanitarian situation in the region at the and the after effects of the current war. Firstly, the context for humanitarian action. Secondly, the humanitarian actors that we see in the region at the moment. And lastly, the experience and the effects of humanitarianism for the local population. And I want to stress that I speak as a historian of humanitarianism. I'm not associated with a humanitarian organization, and I'm not a policy analyst. So my comments come from the perspective of a historian who is interested in the way that the past shapes both conflict and responses to conflict in the region. So the context for humanitarianism in the region at present. So it seems an obvious place to start as a historian by pointing out that this isn't an isolated crisis, and any humanitarian response to what is happening at the moment is taking place in the shorter term context of the unresolved aftermaths of the last war in Karabakh, as Lawrence pointed out, but also in terms of in the context of a longer term history of war, genocide and displacement in the region. So from the First World War, the Armenian genocide and the mass displacement which followed in the aftermath, and which, just like the First World War, has a lot of unaddressed and unacknowledged aftermaths. This history, it shapes the way that conflict plays out in the region, but it also shapes how populations respond to conflict, the choices that they make in a time of crisis, and how they interpret their own experiences. Furthermore, it shapes the nature of responses to crisis at a local level, what kind of humanitarian responses are appropriate or what is possible, but also how people respond to intervention. So there is a long history of international intervention in the region, and this shapes trust and how people feel about that in the contemporary situation. The second issue I wanted to, second context I wanted to talk about was that of access. Lawrence has already said that organizations, because of the uncertain situation now and the lack of a clear plan or path to peace and stability, there is uneven access, for different kinds of humanitarian agencies and actors. So there is uncertainty about who can and who should act, whether that's the UNHCR or the EU. So these issues challenge the idea that is often associated or with humanitarianism, that it should be universal. And we know that that's not a new issue, but it's very striking here. I think there's also a bigger question about who and what comes to matter for the international humanitarian imagination. So what constitutes a crisis that deserves an international response? And we might think here about the coverage or lack thereof in the international media of this conflict, and also in the sort of complex interdependency between humanitarian actors and the media. And I think this has been made even more complex in the context of this conflict by social media and the kind of interventions and amplification that Lawrence talks about. The third point was about and this builds on the point about social media, was that any humanitarian response to the current crisis is taking place in the context of really fierce, really vociferous critiques of international organizations and especially of human rights organizations. So the idea that these organizations fail to speak out quickly or forcefully enough about violence against civilians and war crimes. There's also, of course, a longer term context here of a lack of faith in the peace process and international engagement with that. So we see again another idea that's at the core of humanitarianism, or the idea of what humanitarianism should be, that is neutrality and impartiality. We see that being questioned in the current context. So what responsibilities do different organizations have to speak out? What is the cost of speaking out? What compromises do you make if you don't speak out? In sum, this whole critique means that the current response to the aftermath of war is taking place in a climate of huge distrust. And that's a challenge for any organisation that is going to engage in the region. So more generally, I think there is a question here about how the lines are being drawn between what is humanitarian issue and what is a political issue here. Now, we know that while humanitarianism might be generally positioned in opposition to politics, in reality, it is always political and engaged in, or can be part of a variety of political projects. And I think we need to understand here in this case, why are certain issues humanitarian? what does it mean to try to assign something to a humanitarian sphere? Does it depoliticize particular issues, for example, refugee resettlement, and with what consequences? In the time I've got left, I wanted to say something about actors. I don't want to give a kind of comprehensive list of organisations involved. I just want to highlight some of the, I think, changes or new elements we might see here. So I think what we need to do is look beyond the familiar international organisations to understand the humanitarian landscape in the South Caucasus at the moment. And this, I think, follows a trend in research on humanitarianism more generally, which has meant looking beyond Anglo-European or Northern relief organisations and challenging the idea of North-South transfer as the kind of dominant paradigm for how we understand humanitarianism. So I just want to point to three kinds of actors. So the first, diaspora organisations, and I'm thinking about the Armenian context here, so we could think about newer organisations like the Aurora Foundation or older ones like Hayastan Al-Armenia Fund. Diaspora humanitarianism has a long history, but it's not necessarily well understood. And I wonder if we can think about how these diaspora organisations fit into the bigger picture. Do they appear more authentic, perhaps, in an environment of distrust of international organisations that I talked about? I think there's a question here about... or a challenge here in not assuming that diaspora responses are a single thing. The Armenian diaspora is very fractured, and we need to think about the different diaspora and political projects and identity projects, I suppose, that are involved in humanitarian endeavours. The other element I thought is noticeable is the presence of Russian peacekeeping forces, which may not seem an obvious thing to discuss when it comes to a humanitarian landscape, but there is a long history of entanglement between the military and humanitarianism. And I think that rather than just say, well, this isn't real, or, you know, is this just geopolitics or neo-imperialism, we need to ask questions like, why and how is the vocabulary of humanitarian being used by in the Russian case? So if you look at recent reports on the work they're doing on TASS, this word humanitarianism figures a lot. What does it mean for those peacekeepers on the ground that are doing work like helping with refugee resettlement or distributing food? And how is this experienced by local populations? Finally, I think it's important that we don't forget local responses to displacement. And again, this has been a recurring theme in recent research on humanitarianism, things like Eleanor Fidding Casimir's work on refugee hosts, that local actions, and sometimes actions by populations who have already been displaced themselves, and that's very much the context in the South Caucasus, are themselves become humanitarian actors. So two things that I've noticed recently are this kind of refugee humanitarianisms, but also a growth in, or a pivot of, women's organizations in Armenia towards providing relief and relief, which is underpinned by a kind of a feminist principle. And I think it's interesting to think about where that fits into the bigger picture. I think there's also a question to be asked about local relief. So what benefits does that bring? But also to remember that that isn't necessarily immune from being part of political projects or social hierarchies in itself. So how do these things shape local relief priorities and practices, with what consequences? Finally, I just wanted to come back around to something which, in the history of humanitarianism at least, it is often missed or has not been as much of a focus as it should be, and that is the experiences of those who are on the receiving end of humanitarian endeavours, those that are the objects of humanitarianism, as some historians would have it. And I think that I think it's just worth turning to a quotation from Elizabeth Cullen Dunn's work, which addresses, it's actually on the protracted displacement in Georgia. And she's written extensively on the experiences of IDPs who lived for a long time in camps. And while we're weeks rather than years after the end of this conflict, given the ongoing uncertainty and absence of a basis for lasting peace, it doesn't seem premature to think about this observation that she makes. So she says, the new humanitarian order often presents itself as an extension of the chaos of war, a kind of permanent disruption that renders life unpredictable, leaves people at risk of violence and poverty, and prevents them from making their own plans for their new lives. So I want to finish by asking, you know, amid the urgent interventions and the longer term worries about reconstruction and rehabilitation and the claims made by on their behalf by local, international and diasporic actors, what space is there for those who have been displaced by this conflict or who have become victims of this conflict in other ways to tell their own stories and to shape their own futures? I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Joe. Thank you, Lawrence. That's a splendid set of initial remarks, a great introduction, actually a lot more than an introduction to our topic. I'm going to allow myself to share as privilege and maybe ask each one of our panelists one question, and then we will open it to Q&A from the audience. And in doing so, let me reverse the order. Let me start with Joe. Joe, you're a historian by training and by academic work. Tell us a little bit about what we can learn from history in terms of the success or lack of success of humanitarian relief efforts. Is there anything that has been done this time around that learns from previous conflicts, whether in the Caucasus or elsewhere? Or if you want to phrase it differently, is there anything we should be learning now that might be applicable to future relief efforts in other conflicts in other parts of the world? You talked about narratives, practices, discourse, anything that we should be jotting down for use in the future.
In the future, yeah. It's really difficult, I think, as historians to provide direct lessons from the past. And I think this is what everybody wants from historians, but which we find very difficult to give because of the specificities of previous events and previous responses to conflict or displacement. But I think what we can do, we can usefully do as historians is help to contextualize and to question things which we might otherwise take for granted. So for example, I talked about the presence of about the entanglement between the military and humanitarianism, and sometimes people say, well, you know, this is new, once upon a time humanitarianism was pure and it was unpolluted by politics or the military. Well, you know, we look back to the Caucasus between say 1918 and 1920 and we see the American Relief Administration and the entanglement of military and humanitarianism. You know, we can look back and critique international responses, you know, powers like, well, Britain and that Britain's narrative of, about being kind of a friendly place for refugees and having saved populations and intervened well in the past. Well, historians can kind of challenge those narratives quite easily. The other thing I think we can do in situations like this is talk with practitioners in the humanitarian sphere. So recently at Manchester, in our Humanitarianism and Conflict Response Institute, we work with a professional development course with MSF and other organisations. And just a few weeks ago, we had a very useful and very robust discussion about this conflict between historians and practitioners, where we talked about the way that the past shapes people's understanding of this conflict and so on. So I think those kinds of things are more possible than direct lessons.
Thank you very much. Lawrence, let me turn it over to you. We've been talking about humanitarian efforts, relief efforts, but much of your work is focused on peace building. Clearly the war ended recently, so I don't know if this is the right moment to be talking about peace building. Perhaps every moment is the right moment to be talking about that. Are there any ongoing efforts at peace building today in the region? What actors are involved? Can you tell us a little bit about sort of the impact of earlier efforts at peace building and what we ought to be thinking about today?
Sure. Well, let's be frank and say that it's a very difficult moment right now to talk about peace building. A lot of people have written off peace building, said that peace building has failed. During the war, there were attacks on those who expressed more kind of counter-war or anti-war views or who were articulating the case for peace. I think there are now also very different understandings as to what peace building should prioritize. Should it prioritize regional development or should it focus on the political issues that remain unresolved? And at the same time as all of this ambiguity, there's clearly a very urgent need for communities that, you know, we've had a kind of a long distance segregation of Armenian and Azerbaijani communities over the past nearly 30 years. And that has now suddenly overnight unraveled. And you've got communities who are saturated with the worst possible stereotypes about one another, now will be living in close proximity and potentially even using the same infrastructure. So, you know, there really is an urgent need for the kind of work that peace building can encompass. In terms of, you know, previous efforts, I think it's important to remember the context in which peace building came into the South Caucasus. It was a kind of a partner to democratic transition, and it was based on the idea of convergence, that a democratic transition, a liberalized market and peace would come together and mutually reinforce one another. Now, of course, that's not the situation that we've had in Armenia and Azerbaijan over the intervening period. At least until 2018 in Armenia, you had stably non-democratic regimes who in different ways were dependent on and drew upon the conflict in order to demobilize an agenda and an appetite for reform amongst parts of their population. I think we have to recognize also that there's been very limited social demand for peace. You know, the two countries have basically built their post-Soviet identities around their Karabakh narrative. And that narrative and identity has been instilled at every stage in the formation of citizens. And so peace building is in a sense up against nation building in full swing. And so you've never had a kind of a functional relationship between, you know, what practitioners refer to as track one and track two. It's been an incredibly secretive peace process without that kind of dialogue and the potential for ideas to move around between the different tracks. Now, with all of that said, and with very realistic ambitions as to what peace building is and can achieve, there are efforts to resume peace building initiatives. The principal actor here is the European Union, which took over from the UK in this role around 10 years ago. And there are efforts in train to re-establish track two civil society-led dialogue and to build capacity and also to counter the polarization of the media space. And what we've seen in the trilateral declaration and the more recent document that was signed in Moscow is a very hard framework for a new regional design. It's very geopolitical, it's very top down. And what peace building needs to think about is the soft infrastructure. How do you actually make this very hard framework both viable and legitimate for the people that have to live within that framework? And so that's how I see the agenda for peace building. It's across a very broad spectrum of issues, from regional development to justice and accountability to countering the foundational narratives that sustain the conflict.
Thank you very much. That's fascinating, grim, but realistic and very, very interesting. So let me turn to a few of the questions. Some of the questions are rather long. Let me just see. Okay, so first question comes from Vahid Aliyev, who's from the Center for Security Analyses and Prevention in Prague. And the question is for either one of our two speakers. And it's about the situation of POWs. What are the arrangements currently in force? And do they cover those captured after the trilateral agreement was signed? So what can we expect there? And what can we expect over a number of areas? The question is rather long, so I'm going to summarize it, in which there are ambiguities as to what was agreed and what the fate of those prisoners of war ought to be. Either for Lawrence or for Joe, would like to have a go at that.
Well, I think the question is pushing at the idea that these are not prisoners of war. Mm-hmm. The people who are currently detained on the Azerbaijani side, and therefore that they wouldn't necessarily be covered by the 10th of November agreement. But I think, you know, the underlying issue here is, you know, is it peace or is it continued conflict? And, you know, the retaining of prisoners feeds the conflict dynamic, and it does seem to be playing a kind of a political role. And so I think that's the choice. And it kind of links into a bigger choice, I think, for Azerbaijan. And, you know, Azerbaijan decides more in this context than Armenia does. It has greater leverage. It's come out of this war victorious, but it essentially needs to decide whether to opt for a strategy of domination, or a strategy that would over time lead to the potential for partnership with Armenia, however paradoxical or unlikely that might sound at the moment. And it seems to me that the retaining of prisoners in this context doesn't serve any particular security goals, but it might serve political goals if continued conflict and domination is the strategy. So I think it's, you know, a question that Azerbaijan needs to answer for itself. What is the goal of not releasing prisoners in this situation?
Thank you. Next question is from Diana Gazarian, who is an MPP student here at the LSE. And her question is about atrocities committed against war prisoners. There are numerous videos, she says, in which the Azerbaijani military execute Armenian prisoners and commit all kinds of atrocities. Given this information, it seems clear that Azerbaijan failed to fulfill the measures imposed by the European Court of Human Rights. Given this, what do you think ought to be done? What actions by the international community are appropriate at this point? And what other kinds of mechanisms ought to be in place to make sure this kind of thing does not happen again? Either Lawrence or Joe, if either one of you would like to give that difficult question a try.
I think that's a really difficult question to answer, and I'm not a lawyer nor am I a historian of international law, so I don't want to enter into the technicalities of the legal situation, but I think what I can say here is if these atrocities aren't addressed and if there isn't a process and what that process could be, it still seems really difficult to say. I've heard people mention, for example, a commission to investigate, or if those things aren't addressed, then they will fuel further conflicts in the region, just as unaddressed atrocities in the last war and unaddressed atrocities going back to the 1920s or the 1910s do. the mechanisms, I don't know. And I think there is something here again about what the political will and goals of Azerbaijan and Armenia are at the moment, what the priorities are and how that can shape that. Lawrence might be able to say more about the particularities of or the processes that are ongoing at the moment.
Well, I'm like, it is a very complex question, but I think one thing one mechanism would be an international investigation. So the Tagliavini investigation of the South Ossetia war in August 2008, I think was an important step in generating an impartial record of what happened. I think there could be a very important role played by such an investigation in the current situation. I think also support to those domestic actors that are investigating and seeking accountability for atrocities and for war crimes is another important aspect of this, supporting those who are documenting human rights issues. And then over the longer term, broader work to deal with the past, to address the atrocities and unresolved legacies of the First War, which I alluded to in my presentation, to break this cycle of impunity that has characterized Armenian-Azerbaijani relations over the last 30 years, to break taboos and to break the cycle of arguments based on what about arguments. So many Armenian-Azerbaijani dialogues are shut down by the mention of Sumgait or Hojali, and that's been the case for many, many years now. And so I think a broader process to address that would be a longer term strategy to solve these issues.
Thank you, Lawrence. Let me move on. We have several more questions coming in. Next question is from Armen Grigorian. And he says, from Azerbaijan's perspective, Karabakh is Azerbaijani. Therefore, the government conducted military operations against an ethnic and religious minority within its own country. What is the responsibility, in your view, of Azerbaijan for having conducted a military offensive against those that the Azerbaijan government considers part of its own people? And what ought to be the humanitarian response in this case?
Well, again, this is touching on a kind of complex legalistic arguments. And I would underline, I myself am not a lawyer, nor am I a humanitarian worker or expert as such. The arguments will rage around whether that was illegitimate and a crime to launch a military offensive against a minority in one's own country, or whether this was not a military aggression as such. It was an operation to restore territorial integrity in the face of an externally supported military force on Azerbaijani territory. And, I don't have an answer to that. But I think what we will see in future years when cases go to the European Court of Human Rights is that the conduct of the war was featured grave war crimes conducted. And I think, that will be the focus of future legal processes and kind of legal responses to this war. Joe, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
I don't think I can. I have similar conclusions to you there. But I think in terms of the humanitarian response, humanitarian agencies have different conceptions of their own responsibility. And for some, this is about saving life, whatever and wherever the political circumstances. Others are more focused towards speaking out and documenting. But I think whatever the debates will follow about the legality of the war and the grounds for the war and the way it was conducted, when we talk about humanitarian response, we have to come back to the people that have suffered as a result. And I suppose that's why I ended by talking about, you know, the people that have been the victims of this war. And, you know, we can talk about, I suppose, I feel like the focus always has to come back to that.
Thank you. These are indeed very, very difficult questions in which the legal, the humanitarian, and the political all get mixed up in ways that are not easy to disentangle. We have a few questions that focus on sort of more global or international aspects, coming also from people in different countries. Let me turn to a question by Nick, who's at the University of Erlangen in Germany. And Nick would like to know, would a more democratic Azerbaijan be a positive force in the peace process? And is there any hope for that?
Well, I think potentially a more democratic Azerbaijan would be able to address the issue of credible commitments. So one of the problems associated with the regime type that we've seen in Azerbaijan over the trajectory of the peace process is that it has a commitment problem. There aren't examples within the Azerbaijani body politic and the political system of delegated constitutional power or of pluralism that Karabakh Armenians could look at and see, okay, there is a precedent, there is a practice, there are strong legal institutions, there is rule of law, that if we were to be in a position of subordination within a vertical structure, within Azerbaijani statehood, that our rights and obligations would be respected. So I think that would be the key kind of, one of the key benefits that a more democratic Azerbaijan might bring to the conflict dynamic as compared to recent years. And democratic regimes obviously are also less likely to turn to coercion. They're more likely to opt for diplomatic solutions to conflicts. But part of the question was how likely we are to see that. Well, it's obviously impossible to look into the future, but I think, you know, there are lots of structural obstacles to a democratic transition in the foreseeable future in Azerbaijan. So it's not something that I'm expecting anytime soon.
Joe, would you like to add anything on that?
Yeah, I think that a more democratic regime and the possibility of opening up more open dialogue about the past and to be able to challenge the kind of very rigid narratives about the past which have been produced in the context of the current regime can only be helpful. But I think that there is care to be taken in, I suppose, understanding the difference between having a democracy, having a more democratic, I suppose, understanding that a more democratic regime doesn't necessarily bring an automatic shift in public opinion, and there is still change on the ground that would need to happen in order to think about more stable and more peaceful full region. But democratic change at the top can't go against that. But I don't think it's the full story. The political side of that, I suppose.
Yeah, just to add to that, you know, the social science literature highlights how democratic transitions in and of themselves are high risk periods in conditions of pre-existing conflict. So, you know, that's the risk of a democratic transition. I think there are research that shows that it's within the first year of a democratic transition is a high risk period. And, you know, one could argue that Armenia's Velvet Revolution has been a kind of one of the contributory factors to the outbreak of violence last September. So there's some kind of, you know, backup for that argument. But over the long term, of course, bilateral reciprocal democratization, I think, would be the optimal route to a resolution.
That would be the optimal outcome indeed. Whether it's possible or not, of course, is far from clear. There's a question on the role of the US from Margaret Padovano, who'd like to know first whether the US has sent any aid to Armenia. And let me add of my own accord, whether the change in administrations in the United States makes any difference, and whether one might expect a Biden administration to play a role, or is it simply that President Biden will be otherwise engaged and too busy to focus much on this particular issue?
Well, I think I would say there, we hope for more engagement. It certainly couldn't be less than it has been over the last 4 years. But we have to also be realistic again. The last time that the United States really invested any serious interest or political capital in the resolution of this conflict was in 2001 at peace talks at Key West in Florida in April 2001. In September of that year, of course, 9/11 radically transformed the foreign policy landscape from an American perspective in ways that we still see today, and where there's very little room for a conflict in the South Caucasus. So I think with Biden, Biden has made a number of sort of rhetorical commitments. I think there will be some galvanizing of re-engaging with the Minsk group of the OSCE. But in terms of a broader regional policy, I think we shouldn't expect too much, but it will be, I think, better than it has been under Mike Pompeo.
Yeah, I couldn't give you any figures for US aid or how that has or hasn't changed since this current the current conflict. I think that one point which we haven't raised and which I meant to mention in the talk is that obviously the COVID crisis and the context of it, any international response comes in the financial and the capacity issues that and the access issues that raises. So that's probably, it doesn't answer your question, I'm afraid. I'm kind of circling round, but I think that this is something that we really, that will have to be really, it will impact a lot on the humanitarian response to the current war.
And following up on that, and speaking of other large countries that have had a role in this conflict, there are a couple of questions about the role of Turkey, which clearly has been important. Having dispatched the US, what can we say about Turkey and its role, both past and future?
Well, Turkey has transformed its role. Turkey was an ambivalent bystander to the conflict for many years. It was, in the unipolar world that followed the end of the Cold War, it was, firmly embedded within the NATO alliance. It was a key US ally, and it acted very cautiously with regard to the Karabakh conflict. And that has changed in recent years. I always link this to a broader global transition from a unipolar American-dominated world order to a multipolar world order where regional powers seek to establish nearer broads and spheres of influence. And I think Turkey is kind of a textbook example of the latter. It has basically, I think, seen an opportunity to assert itself and become a South Caucasus security actor. And Russia has had little choice but to accede to that. And in a way, Russia and Turkey are, it's a kind of a competitive cooperation paradigm where they are assisting one another, and they are very, they're necessary for each other, for both powers' plans to be more strategically autonomous on the global stage. What I would also say, though, is that while Russia has reasserted its role as a security actor very visibly with the deployment of a peacekeeping contingent and so on, Turkey's bandwidth of engagement, I think, is rather wider. It plays a secondary role in the peacekeeping mandate. It's just participating in the ceasefire monitoring center that's on Azerbaijani territory. The main security gain was the vivid demonstration of Turkish technology and doctrine defeating a Russian Soviet armed and doctrined army during the war itself. But the transit corridors that have been mandated by the trilateral agreement of the 10th of November, I think, open up the South Caucasus to Turkish soft power, to Turkish economic influence in ways that actually make it potentially the principal strategic winner of the recent conflict. So at least that's how I see things today.
Thank you. Thank you, Lawrence. I'm looking at the clock and I'm afraid that we only have about 3 or 4 minutes left. There are a number of more questions, but I don't think we can tackle all of them. There's one question which sort of takes a bird's eye view and asks both panelists, maybe this would be a nice way for them to add anything else that they wish to say before, regrettably, we have to come to an end for the discussion. Taking a long historical perspective, G. Leslie asks, can you please reflect on sort of the rights and wrongs of the conflict? This is not a conflict that began yesterday, nor will it end tomorrow, but if one were to imagine a long-term resolution to the conflict, what might that look like? What elements would have to be on the table? That and any concluding thoughts from each one of you in about a minute or two at most each, we'll be very, very grateful for. Who'd like to lead off? Joe, maybe?
Sure. So, I guess as a historian, I only ever really think about this in the long view, and I'm going to reiterate something that I said before, in that in order to have peace and stability in the region, we can't, local and international engagement does not only have to grapple with what has happened in the last few months or even 30 years, but the longer term history of the region. And I think that goes beyond Armenia, Azerbaijan, Karabakh, and includes Turkey as well. So we local and international actors to think critically about more open and more interactive histories which take into account conflict but also see other aspects of the region's past. I think that has to be acknowledged if we want to move forward. Lawrence might be able to say something more on the practical level of this.
Well, obviously it's a huge question, but I would emphasize the factor of local participation. Armenians and Azerbaijanis have got to sort this out for themselves, by themselves, with themselves. And if they don't do that, then others will come in and fill the space. And I think we've just seen that very vividly. I think that for Azerbaijan, of course, the justice element of redressing the grievances of the 90s has been key, and it's currently, you know, strongly supported by Turkey. But over time, the broader cost to sovereignty of this outcome, I think, will become clearer. It's already been clear for Armenia for a long time that sustaining the conflict has brought very grave cost to the exercise of sovereignty. And so I think ultimately, you know, the precondition, as I see it, for a resolution of the conflict are sovereign Armenian and Azerbaijani states who are capable of negotiating their interests with one another and legitimating power domestically. And so it is really, I think, a case of simultaneous transformations. But I think local initiative and responsibility is absolutely key. And without that, we won't see a resolution of the conflict.
Thank you very, very much. I think our time is pretty much up. I would like to thank everybody who had a role in putting this wonderful event together, particular Professor Bob Babajanian from the School of Public Policy, who did a lot of work to make sure that we could have this conversation today. to Lawrence Brewers, to Joe Laycock, to the whole SPP team, and of course for, you know, the more than 70 people that joined us today from different corners of the world. Thank you very, very much. This is a difficult, but nonetheless very interesting and very important subject. I suspect this is not the last conversation we will have on it. So thank you very, very much, everyone. Thank you, Lawrence and Joe, once again. And I hope to see you all soon at some other School of Public Policy event. Good afternoon. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you. Bye.